Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senzino, host of Jake and Gino Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbo. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, I'm doing great, brother. How are you this morning?
Always making it happen, big man. It's tax season, and today we got a CPA here with Anderson Tax. They help successful business owners and entrepreneurs cut their tax bills to fuel growth. So without further ado, Preston Anderson, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This is awesome.
It is awesome. You're in a good spot right now. And before the show, we were talking a little bit about 08 and, you know, people getting cut in half during the recession. So why don't you share with us a little bit about your background and how you got into the business?
Yeah. So I've been, I started doing taxes in 2004. I was one of those kids in high school, incredibly socially awkward, and doing the crazy math classes as a high schooler. I was doing like senior level college classes very, very, very quickly. And so I always knew I was going to do something with math, and I started taking accounting classes and realized I loved accounting. I loved helping people save money. And so I started, my first tax season was like 04, and I just realized this is what I want to do. I love seeing people, save money. Like my passion is to, when I can go into somebody's business and like restructure them and kind of show them some deductions that they've missed and they save $30,000, $40,000, or $300,000. I mean, that's when I get jacked. I get excited to see people save that much money, be able to basically use that for themselves instead of giving it to Uncle Sam.
Preston, what are some of the things you see when you walk into an office of somebody you've never done their taxes before and you save them $30,000, $40,000, $300,000? What are some of the big mistakes that they're making?
Structure is the first thing we look at, how they are structured. So,
entity structure?
Yeah, entity structure. Okay. So a lot of times, well, I'm just going to share something with myself where we actually cost ourselves a couple $100,000 last 2 years ago, and it wasn't from a tax savings. It was from a liability standpoint. Mm-hmm. I love separating out all of your separating out risk is what I do now. 2 years ago, my wife and I, we had an event where my brother-in-law actually died a month before the event, and my wife was not in a good place. And so we ended up canceling that event. Had I put that event in a separate LLC under our LLC, it would have saved us about $200,000. But because my brother-in-law passed away, we ended up canceling the event. I had to pay out of pocket for all of those things. And we got sued for non-payment to a vendor who we paid like half. And they're like, well, we want payment in full. And so we kind of got hosed a little bit. So it's
Are you saying you would have just shut the LLC down and not paid anybody?
100%. Yeah. Yeah, because it was a one-time event that we were going to do, and that I learned my lesson, believe me. But having that LLC would have saved me about $200,000. But
would you have been doing the right thing? Like if you made a promise, right? Obviously, life happens and whatnot, and you made a promise to pay. Like it gets a little weird there too, no?
Yeah, for sure. So like with one of these vendors, they sued us. We paid them half. They mm-hmm. didn't. They didn't do all of the work that we had contracted for. Mm-hmm. But they said, hey, you owe us in full, even for expenses that they didn't incur. They're like, well, you owe us for flights that we didn't take and for auto and hotels that we didn't take. And I thought they were being a little ridiculous, mm-hmm. but we would have saved on attorney's fees. We would have saved with them. I thought they were being beyond ridiculous, but we ended up getting sued. We ended up settling. I think we could have won, but whatever the attorneys were going to take was just going to be at that point more. So we ended up settling and just saying, no, screw it. We'll just give you the money and just go away. Mm-hmm. So personally, I would have been fine just cutting it and running and been totally fine. But I agree with you. Like, yes, if you make promises and you do those things, yes, absolutely. Keep those promises. But if they don't do the work,
yeah,
I personally don't feel like they should have gotten paid in full.
Right.
But that's just me.
So structures. So what else do you see when you go in there? You're separating.
There's multiple reasons to have structures. One is to save taxes, but the bigger one, honestly, is risk mitigation. Because if something happens in your life, like a brother-in-law passing away, if you have a structure if somebody sues you, they can only go after what's in that structure. They can't go after your personal. They can't go after all of your other separate entities. And so how people are structured is one of the biggest things. I had a kid come to me earlier this, late last year, and he was structured properly. And he thought, oh, he's doing everything right. He made about $3 million net profit. And he had his S corp. So he was saving on self-employment tax, but he was going to take like a $50,000 W-2. And by actually raising his W-2 to about $700,000, that one thing actually saved him $100,000. You're thinking, how on earth does that happen? And it's like he ended up paying more in that like self-employment tax or the employment taxes. But by raising that W-2 up to a number where it actually maximized his, it's called a Qubit. So like he got a 50% deduction on that 700 grand. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at people, I look at kind of a holistic view. I look at not just what they're doing this year, but what they're going to be doing over the next 3, 5, 10, their entire life. Because oftentimes what I see is accountants, what they will do is, you ever see those stress balls where you squeeze them and then things pop out the other side?
Mm-hmm. If you squeeze, kids love those.
Yeah, they love them, right? So do accountants, okay? They squeeze them really hard. And then what happens is on the back end, things pop out. And so when you try to squeeze everything out of a single year, what happens is it often squirts into the next year. And we live in what's called like a progressive tax rate. So if you make a dollar today, or like your next dollar could be taxed more than the current dollar, right? Mm-hmm. And so we go from that 10 to 12 to 22 all the way up to 39% tax, I think it is now, or 37, I can't remember. But when people try to squeeze everything out of every dollar, they often will squeeze too much. And then when it, in the following year, I've seen it where somebody goes negative in 1 year, they pay literally $0 in tax. The next year, their income pops to 600,000 or 700,000. And then all of a sudden they're owing 200,000 over a 2 year span when had they try to bring those two numbers in line and go 350, 350, they would have saved $70,000 or $100,000. Mm-hmm. And so we look at some of those things holistically, not just in each individual year in a silo, but try to look at everything on a timeline to see, all right, where are you going to be this year? Where are you going to be next year in the future? So Jake, you had something?
Yeah. So let's go back to this entity piece for a second. So Give me an example besides say a live event, where you would create a new entity, and then what dollar amount, and I know this is probably personalized to the individual or group, but what dollar amount do you look at to say, I'm spending X amount on this event, I'm looking at doing a new entity, and what types of scenarios do you look to create a new entity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's all about risk, okay? And so it's, you want to silo risk, and the more money you have at stake, the more likely you want to create that entity. Creating an entity in some states is as little as $50. Okay. Literally spending $50 would have saved me $200,000. And it wasn't even so much about the revenue of that entity, but it's about how much you have at risk. Okay. And so that's where you want to look at those, basically siloing those entities. There are some structures where you can actually, I've seen attorneys set up an LLC where it's just a signing LLC and there's no actual, assets in it. And so when they sign it's, and then they assign the income of that entity. And so I've seen attorneys do that where they create a signing LLC where all that LLC does is just takes on the liability and nothing else. And so
it's, like, let's use an example. You have a multifamily building and you sign a contract for $100,000 roof. You actually don't have the entity holding the building signed for the roof. You have this signing company signed for it. And if you back out, like, is that a fair example? 'Cause I'm trying to expand upon this.
Okay. So I've seen, people do that. Yes. I think a really great example in real estate, Ted Turner, I think it was, owned a ski resort, and every pin of that ski resort, so every property has its own pin, he had in its own separate LLC. So if somebody fell on the mountain in one specific pin, they had to sue that specific pin. They couldn't sue the whole mountain. And so everything was separated, and it was all based off of risk and about, I think that was Ted Turner that did that. And it wasn't that each one filed its own tax return. So it wasn't creating a world of tax returns, because that creates a massive headache. Instead, he was just separating the risk out by PIN. Okay. Really cool. And that's a famous example from what, 20, 30 years ago or something like that, whenever he did that.
Yeah, so I'm just looking for real world examples, because you know most of our listeners probably aren't going to own a ski resort. Right. So I was just looking for more like real world examples. Like I yours was cool. Like, okay, you're doing this event; it's going to cost you $250,000. So with that being said, shield that from your other entities and create its own. What other areas you see people? I'm just looking to say like where's the practical use besides event?
Okay, so when you have different lines of business, okay. I'll go back to my example. So what I have in my structure, I have an LLC it's an LLC that's taxed as an S corp. And then that is a holding company of my tax business. My tax business is one separate entity. I'm restructuring. So my bookkeeping is a separate entity, and then my employees are held and I lease my employees through a third entity. So I separate my employee risk, the bookkeeping risk and the tax risk in three separate silos. So if something happens in one of those entities and they sue me in one of those entities, they can only go after one of those things. They can't go after the other two. Okay. And so once again, it's about separating as much risk as possible. So anytime you have a new line of business, if it's completely separate, I say separate them. Now, when it comes to real estate, if you're doing single family, I don't think it always makes sense, a ton of sense, to have the separate LLCs own each and every single piece of property.
That's always the debate, right? Whenever you go online for people that own single family homes, do I put one in LLC or, you know, house in an LLC? Do I do multiple? I think that's like the most common question on Bigger Pockets probably.
Yeah, that is, it's a question I see a lot. My mom owns 27 pieces of property. 27 individual rental homes. And I think currently they're all structured inside of one LLC. Okay.
What does Preston say about that? Mommy, split this up a little bit.
She's a real estate agent. And so everything, she has her property management separated in one company, her rentals in another. Personally, what I like to see with real estate is if you have multifamily, that all goes in one. But as far as residential, I have never seen so much of a risk with rentals that I've been doing this 20 years. I've never seen somebody sued out of a single family house. What I suggest is get good insurance and then get an umbrella policy above and beyond that. And that generally covers the risk, all of the risk inside of those rentals. Now, if you have something like a multifamily, put each multifamily inside of its own for sure. No question. As far as now there's different types of things like, what is it called? My mind just blanked, but those properties where they have incentives right now, where if you invest inside of these properties, in different areas of the country, I'm really blanking on my mind. You guys probably know like the incentivized, what's that?
I think REITs you're talking about.
No, not REITs. It's the government did it under Trump. I think it was like 16 or 17 that he implemented it.
Opportunity zones.
That's the one. Yeah. The opportunity zones. Thank you. Where you want all of those properties inside of their own. You do not want to have any properties that are, so I separate those out. So if a client has opportunity zone properties, those all go inside of their own structure. Mm. Okay. And then we structure things for real estate based off of ownership. Generally what I do is I put all real estate inside of one LLC that's common ownership. And then anytime they bring in different partners, it's a brand new LLC and we separate it all by ownership. Mm-hmm. And then we have good insurance and then just an umbrella policy to cover anything above and beyond the insurance.
I would say if anybody has questions to reach out to Preston, because the real answer is it depends, because everyone's situation is completely different. Because if Preston's mom, those 27 homes, each one is worth $1.5 million worth of equity, you may be separating each single one of those out. It really depends upon the equity, depends upon what other assets you own. So blanket statement, I owned a couple of small duplexes up in Rochester years and years ago. The equity in those homes were like $30,000 each. It made no sense to put them into separate LLCs. I put them into one. Yeah. You know, was it a pain in the neck when I had to sell one? I had to pull it out of the LLC. It was a little bit more of work. But the bottom line is, if you're going to be doing this, you have a unique type of structure. And what you're also trying to accomplish is you're trying to accomplish some type of estate planning as well. So it's not just something you're worrying about today or tomorrow, but you're trying to create a legacy as you're building these assets and buying these assets. And how do you protect them for today and protect them for the future? So we can get on here and say, hey, put some in an LLC, put some in an S corp, put some in a C corp. What are you trying? Put some in a trust. There's so many different things that you could possibly do. Preston, as you're going on and you're seeing this and you're seeing some type of estate planning, do you see... Have you work with people that do estate planning and any kind of really big mistakes that they're making on that end?
Yeah, a couple. One is I've seen people deed houses to their kids. Don't do that. Real estate has magical properties. Like, right? It's one of those things that you buy it, you borrow from it, that borrowing is tax-free. And then when you die, that real estate, you get a step up in basis. And so if you buy a property for, like you said, $30,000, and then over your lifetime, it increases in value to $100,000, that's $70,000. Well, you probably depreciated it during your lifetime as well. But when you die, your kids get a step up in basis, can sell it for $100,000. It's 100% tax-free to them. So there's no income tax on that whatsoever. They get a step up in basis on all of your properties. So honestly, do not gift real estate to kids. Also, generally, Keep real estate out of S corps. S corps are really terrible for real estate, and they lose some of the benefits of real estate. Wow, those are two things I see often.
So let's talk about some tax savings. I mean, yeah, kids working, you're a real estate professional. Give us some ideas on how you help your clients.
Yeah, for sure. So I've got three kids. My kids help in both my business and my wife's business. My wife has a cookie business. It's really easy for them to help in that one. So one of the things I do anytime a new client comes in, they have kids that are 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, up to 17 years old. We find a way for them to hire the kids inside of the business, and it has to be legitimate. The kids have to actually be doing work, but you can pay your kids up to $13,850 and it's 100% tax-free. So you get a full deduction. What I really love to do with it is them to take that money that they pay them and put $6,500 into their Roth IRAs. So my kids are 8, 10, and 12, and they already have, I think, $25,000 in their Roth IRAs. Okay. It's a beautiful way to basically make tax-free money tax-free forever.
That's awesome. And that Roth money, is there any way for them to pull it out or for them to use it? Or is that money really designated for retirement?
So I designate it for retirement because I pay my kids the full $13,000. Well, not quite the full $13,800, but I pay them what is reasonable for what they do. My daughter, she's 12 years old. I paid her $13,000 last year. Last year it was $6,000 I put into her Roth IRA. The other $7,000 I put into a savings account for her. So that $7,000 she can pull out. We've actually invested it in other things. But my goal with that is when my kids turn 18, I have money for either their college that they can use, starting their first business, buying their first rental, something along those lines, where I'm teaching my kids how to be proactive with their money, not just a consumer, but a producer.
That's awesome. And red flags. What do you see some types of red flags that the IRS is looking for? It's things that people are making mistakes on because it's not tax. What is it? Tax avoidance versus tax. What is this saying?
Okay, yes. So yeah, tax avoidance versus tax evasion. Ask Wesley Snipes. He knows the difference, right? Yeah. So
I don't know. Did he learn his lesson? That's the thing. Does he still know?
Or not? Yeah. So there's a lot of people out there that say you don't have to pay any taxes, or the tax code is fraudulent. So here's a way around not paying your taxes. The biggest red flags I see, honestly, are not filing. Okay. I've had people literally come to me and not file for 10 years. And when you don't do that, when you don't file for a decade,
is that
those
common?
Returns are, oh yeah, Dude, I've been working 20 years. Every single year I've seen it at least once, if not multiple.
How old are these people on average? 40s?
40s. Yeah.
They just opt out?
So it's not generally that. It's something happened in their life. They got a divorce. They got somebody passed away. Something happened where they all of a sudden, like somebody else often was handling it for them, and then they
No longer there. Like they were not like participating members. They had someone taking care of their shit, and then the person.
Right. That's the most common thing I see.
How messy is that going back and trying to clean that up? It's got to be nearly impossible, right?
It depends on the situation. If it's somebody that has 100 rental properties, it's a pain in the rear. It's expensive.
Does the IRS just feast on them at that point? Because like they think they're trying to hide something, obviously, right?
Yeah. So yeah, when those are the returns I see that
those
are
people go to jail often?
No.
The
IRS doesn't care. They just want their money. They don't want, the IRS is not in they're not in the business of putting people in jail. They're in the business of collecting money. Yeah. Okay. I think the IRS only put away something like 1300 people last year, and it was for fraud. Okay. It's when people are, say they made $100,000 when they really made $2 million. Right. And it's hiding money or filing a zero return when they had income on the return. It's for actual fraud, people that are really trying to get away with something. And then the other thing, honestly, is filing on Schedule C. Okay. Putting your income on a Schedule C and having your full business on a Schedule C. Those are the returns that are audited by far the most often in the tax code. So anything you can do to get your return off of Schedule C is good. Because with a Schedule C, you can just make up numbers. And I've seen people do it. And those are the returns that are audited the most. And so you can get things off of Schedule C by putting it on an S-Corp, putting it on a partnership. If you and your spouse have real estate together, I prefer to do things on a partnership versus a Schedule E at this point, because there's more data that the IRS has, and you're less, much, much, much less likely to be audited for that.
I've got a question about the IRS. Why is it taking them so long to process payments? And it's just, they are so far behind. What is up with that?
So in 2020, they burned something like 17 million pieces of mail. Okay. They were so backed up. They just said, screw it, we're going to burn it all. And they just went and shredded literally 17 million or 20 million pieces of mail. And COVID really screwed up the IRS. They ended up, anybody who had a penalty for your 19, 20, 21 returns, they just said, hey, it's forgiven. Okay. As long as you filed by a certain date, it could have been 2 years late and they forgave any penalties. And so 2020 really put the IRS back, and they've never really caught up. Okay. And you hear about them hiring 86,000 new agents. It's not actually new agents that they hired. It's most of them are computer people trying to update their systems, because the IRS is actually working mostly off of like MS-DOS systems from the 1980s. And so it's pretty bad.
It's pretty archaic is what you're saying.
Pretty archaic. Yeah. So they're in the Stone Age for sure.
And so they're going to add another complexity on with this Corporate Transparency Act. Any tips or anything to discuss on that? For me personally, I think it's unconstitutional. It's an undue burden for small tax, business owners. And I think it's actually going to do zero if what it was intended to do is, how is a small LLC going to be laundering money? It's the biggest joke on the planet.
Right. It's not the IRS that did that. It's the Financial Crimes Unit.
Yes.
So it's FinCEN. And it literally takes 5 to 10 minutes to do. I as a CPA can't do them for clients, but I personally think I agree with you. I think most things the IRS does is unconstitutional. I think most things the government does are unconstitutional. But that's me. With it though, it literally takes 5 to 10 minutes to fill out. The problem is for people that have 45 or 50,
I was going to say, like that's LLCs. A minimum of 6 hours for that guy and myself right there.
Right. Yeah. It's
so
a,
you just and stole then, 6 hours of my life and I did nothing wrong.
Like, and if you do it correct, bad. You're saying yeah. 5 or 10 minutes, Jake and Gino will make some errors because we can't look at a screen for more than 10 minutes. We'll start glossing. Jake, if I send Jake more than one paragraph for an email, he's like, Gino, you're killing me, bro. I don't want to see more than this. So you say 5 or 10, we'll make it 30 for each one. So let's let's be realistic.
Yeah, if you've never seen, you've got,
but not to get too personal, then multiply that out by my average wage. Like, am I getting that money back? Like, that's theft, right? No. That's theft of my time.
Well, yes. I think taxes are theft. Okay. Yeah. Which is why I have such a passion to help people not pay them. Okay. And unfortunately, the beneficial ownership information return or report. I mean, when the government said, are we really free? Like, when the government says you have to do something and they're going to put you in jail for 2 years or fine you $500, like, how free are we as a society?
It's the same thing that goes for property. We don't really own, like, we rent property right. from the government, and it's 100%. Pretty gross.
Yeah, property taxes, you pay off the property, you own it free and clear, and you are paying rent for the rest of your life to.
And it's not cheap. Tax. It's not insignificant, right?
So no, for sure not. Mm-hmm. It's like my property tax here on this house is a third of what I pay for my mortgage. Yeah. So, or a third of my mortgage goes to property taxes.
Just keep kicking up to the mafia, friend.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you.
The CTA. So, yeah. Let's continue with the CTA because we can go down this rabbit hole for us for the rest of the show. But
I could talk about that forever, man. I've got a Bush Reagan hat in my background. Anyway. Yeah. Sorry.
CTA.
CTA.
Yeah, the corporate transparency, like you said.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I call it. I call it the boy. It's a lot of acronyms in with the government. Okay, they like their. TLA is 3-letter acronyms. Yeah. So ultimately, I would just file it. If you didn't file it, or if you had your business open prior to December, you have until the end of the year. The problem is if you ever make a change in your business, if you move, if you change your driver's license, if you do any of that, you have to go back and redo all of it every single time.
Ownership. Jake decides to, Gino, you know what? I'm going to buy Gino out of here. Huh?
Guess I'm not moving.
Yeah. So, I mean, with interest rates going up and that, it's like, oh, people have real incentive. If you're at 3% interest on your home, like there is no incentive to move with the boy, with the CTA, with interest rates. It's just like sticking your home as long as you can at this point.
Oh, wow. So let's fill out the CTA. Before we go to short answers, are there any other deductions? We talked about kids. Any other deductions that, you know, business owners out there should be looking at?
Okay. So it kind of depends on their income level. If you're in the $50,000 to $100,000 range, doing a couple of simple things can save you $5,000-$10,000. If you're in the $3 million range, there's more, the world opens up to you. They just become expensive. But if you can drop $100,000 or $200,000 on some things, they can save you more than what they cost you. Mm-hmm. So when you're, in those earlier numbers, I mean, using the Augusta rule, renting out your home to yourself, hiring your kids, and actually putting them to work. With the Augusta rule, actually having the use of the home, the business use of the home. Some of those things can save you. If you have three kids, I mean, that's $40,000 you can pull out of your business, literally tax-free. Mm-hmm. The Augusta rule, depending on how much, it can be $14,000, $20,000, $30,000, depending on how much your home is worth and what the reasonable rate is for that purpose. So there's a lot of things you can do to cut your income from 100 down to 30, right? Or even mm-hmm. to almost nothing. But you have to do it legally. And the biggest thing that I see is documentation. You got to document, right? If you are going to take the Augusta rule, you got to document those meetings. You've got to actually sit down and write down what you're doing. To that legitifies it, right? So somebody just lost an IRS audit where they had the Augusta rule in it. And it wasn't that it went to zero. The auditor just couldn't substantiate the rate. She took it from like $1,500 a day down to $500 a day because they didn't have anything that substantiated it. So if you document that, say, hey, I went out and got a quote from this other company, they were charging $1,500, you can get it. You just have to be mm-hmm. able to show it, okay? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of accountants right now see that that case and say, hey, the IRS said no, we're not taking it at all. And that's not the lesson. The lesson is document properly, right? Mm-hmm. Home office is another one. Like if you have legit, I'm in my basement right now. I work from home, so I take my home office. I take a percentage of my home and that gets reimbursed by my business. Yeah, those are all things that you can do as a business owner. There's a lot of stuff you can do with real estate. We can get into that in a second, but as a specifically as a business owner, those are just a handful of the things we do. There's also something called the supper deduction that I really love. As long as you follow four rules, you can reimburse yourself and employees for meals every time they work overtime. So if somebody works say 10 hours a day, you can reimburse them like $50 every time they do that. As a business owner, as the employee of the company, you can do it to yourself as well. And so if you work overtime, say 100 days a year, that's $5,000 that you can just pull out tax-free or give to employees tax-free. So there's a lot of things that you can do.
I think I mowed some snacks, Gino.
Yeah, so there's, yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. But yeah, ultimately, it depends on where your income is. If your income is... There's different deductions when you're under 100, over 100, over 250. As those different income limits get higher, or as your income gets higher, they're just, the world opens up more and more and more.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you. All right, guys, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from zero units to over $250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Yield Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from zero to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing companies.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey multifamily.
All right, we are back. You mentioned a little bit a minute ago about those real estate benefits. Why don't you explain to the folks briefly what a real estate professional is and why it matters?
Yeah, so a real estate professional is amazing. It's a special tax qualification. As long as you work 750 hours and it is your number one source of income. I shouldn't say source of income. It's your number one driver of time for which you source income. So if you have a business where you work 500 hours a year and you do real estate 750 hours a year, even if the business generates more money, you can still be qualified as a real estate professional. And what a real estate professional is, it allows you to take losses to infinity with real estate. Normally with
it's
real estate.
It's the Buzz Lightyear of tax and real estate.
Yeah. Yeah. So normally you're only able to take $25,000 if your income is below 150. Second, you get above 150, you get nothing. Okay. There is no deduction for losses on real estate. You get nothing. No soup for you. Right. And so when you're below that 150, you get to take it. Above 150, it's zero, unless you have that real estate professional status. And that's, you don't have to be qualified or a licensed agent or anything of that nature. It is literally just time and, once again, document. Okay. Document, document, document. If we're talking like going in and helping you save like $100,000 in income or $200,000 in income, it is so important that you document your time. That, and it can be either spouse. Okay. So if you are a business owner and your spouse doesn't work, hey, put her to work. Have her go get her real estate professional license. Or
we're not there yet. You're getting ahead of me.
Okay, yeah.
So the next piece to that, the real estate professional is great, but really if you're going to add fuel on the fire, you need the second component to this strategy, which is cost segregation. So maybe discuss what cost seg is and how it pairs so finely, like a fine wine, with real estate professional designation.
It does very, very, very well. I'm going to tell you something. It is incredible because, once again, you can literally, like, if you have income, you can take real estate losses.
These are rich folks on this podcast, so they got the income. So let's just assume the income's there, man.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you a horror story of a cost seg in a second, where somebody spent $6,000 on a cost seg and it literally saved them $0. Okay. They got $150,000 of extra depreciation and didn't save a penny because I'll get into that in a second. But a cost seg is basically you go into your property and you itemize all of the different pieces of that property, and real estate is 27 and a half. So the building is 27 and a half, But if you take that property and you turn it upside down, all of the things that fall down, you can take at a different rate. Okay. And we can find ways to depreciate instead of at 27 years, we can depreciate something at say 15 or 10 or 7. And then everything that we can depreciate at that lower rate, we separate from the real estate, from the piece of the property, and we can accelerate that. And with bonus depreciation, you can take, I don't remember if they passed a thing or not. I know it was in Congress. Congress passed it. I don't think the Senate has passed it yet, but they're still redoing tax law for 2023. It's kind of insane. I think it was last I checked, it was 80% that you could take for bonus depreciation. Still maybe 100% for 23 yet. Who knows? But bonus is one they play with all the time, and it's an incentive for the government to, hey, how can we push more money into the economy and get people to spend more, right? That's what bonus depreciation is. It's the government incentivizing people to spend, and you can essentially take all of those things that are depreciated at a lower time frame and push them as much of it into year one as possible. I'm just going to take a quick rant. The tax code really is a system of incentives to spur the economy. It's the tax code has nothing to do with revenue collection for the government. That's just a added bonus. The tax code is really about influencing people's behavior. Okay. If they want you to do something, they give you a benefit for it. They give you bonus depreciation. They give you that real estate professional status. They want you to do those things. If they don't want you to do something, they penalize you for it. They give you a penalty or they whatever. For example, they don't want you to pull money out of an IRA early, so they penalize you for it. They don't want you to pull money out of an HSA, so they penalize you for it. And it's really just a system of penalties and incentives to influence your behavior.
This is really interesting that you bring this up, because in the 80s, it was, you know, don't do drugs. This is your brain on drugs. And now they're handing out syringes. So there's clearly a different agenda in today's government versus years past. Just saying, that popped in my head. Please carry on.
I don't know how you got that. That did not pop into my head.
He made a good point, though, and there's no denying the fact that that's the case. That, like, someone wants people to do drugs. I don't know why. But anyways, carry on.
So I don't disagree with that statement. Anyway, so with like, I'm going to tell you a quick horror story about a COSEG. So yeah. I had a client come to me. They had somebody had done their return, and I was reviewing their previous year's return. Their AGI was like $120,000. Okay. But almost all of their income was from capital gains. And so, it would have been like 120 without the COSEG. The COSEG took them from like 120 down to, I don't remember the exact dollar amount, but it took them really far down. And that $80,000 from like 40 or wherever they were to 120, because it was capital gains, was taxed at $0. And that COSEG literally saved them $0. They paid $6,000 for this thing. The accountant said, hey, this is going to save you a ton of money, and then charge them $6,000. And they didn't save a penny. And they wasted $6,000. But more importantly, they wasted depreciation for future years when they actually had a liability. Okay. Mm. And so once again, I don't look at squeezing that thing every single year. I look at what that, how much juice can we squeeze before it's no longer worth this? No, the juice is no longer worth it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, once you stop getting juice out, you stop squeezing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And especially if it's going to make next year's tax situation worse, or future year situation much worse.
So that was a one-off, but in most instances, COSEG does what for people?
It will reduce their income, right? So if somebody has a COSEG,
by quite a bit, most likely, right?
Most likely, yeah. On a COSEG, if they have $1 million of income, and they find a way to pull out $100,000 on a property and pull it into a COSEG and pull it down, I mean, if they're in the top tax bracket, it'll save them 37%.
Yeah.
Okay. If they're in California in the top tax bracket, it's 50%. Right. Yeah.
And how do you unlock the full benefits of cost segregation?
Yeah. So once again, it's that real estate professional status.
There we go. That's where I was trying to get to. You put those together. So maybe just to, and again, bring it home for us. When you get a good cost seg and real estate professional, you know, what does that do for you?
Yeah. So it allows you to basically, like I said before, you get to take those losses to infinity. Okay. And so, what you can do,
but they got to be paired together.
They got to be paired together. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. 100%. but it allows you to, when you're earning a lot of money in other areas, it allows you to basically write off income against other income, right? It allows you to take deductions against your other income. If you don't have that other income, it doesn't make sense. But if you have a ton of it, it makes an absolute ton of sense. Now, the problem is if you have a ton of income, you probably aren't qualified as a real estate professional because you are going to be, your 750 hours.
Let's say this. Let's say it a different way. You're a high earning doctor, sales professional, or engineer, and you own real estate. Your main mode of income is doctor, sales professional, or engineer. Therefore, you're basically DQ'd. You can use some of that cost seg. So the life hack is, to your point, I think earlier, marry up, right? Get a very savvy wife who is a real estate professional managing those businesses. And then what happens?
So once that wife starts managing those businesses and she starts
not the businesses, that, meaning the real estate.
The real estate businesses. Sorry. Yeah. She gets that real estate professional status. Even if she's not licensed, you can take that against your earned income. So you can take real estate losses against earned income. So if you're a doctor making $1 million a year, you go put money down in real estate. And here's the cool thing about real estate. I'm going to get into debt in a second. But you can essentially put 20% down or 25% down on investment properties. And sometimes you can even take more in deductions than you put down. So you get a bigger deduction in that first year than it actually cost you in cash. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so it saves you.
Say that again for people, because they may have missed it. And this is really important.
Okay. So with real estate, you can borrow money against the property. You only have to put down a percentage. So say you put down 25%.
With $250,000
and $1 million property.
Yep.
You can do in a cost seg. You can potentially get a bigger deduction than the entire.
Because you made $1 million in income.
Yep.
Yep. You put down $250,000. Mm-hmm. And you're basically
estate, yeah. You have a property ahead. That's worth $1 million. You do a cost seg on it, and you get a say $300,000 deduction that first year.
Woohoo!
You're only out $250,000, but you get a bigger deduction than it cost you. Okay.
And you just got an asset for free, essentially.
Essentially, yeah. So
this is when they say, now we're cooking with peanut oil.
Peanut oil, there we go. I love debt. I think debt is something to be respected, not feared. And I think in real
respect
estate—
Respect the debt.
Respect it, yeah, 100%. Too many people in real estate have their risk meter taken away from them. Okay. When they think real estate, they just toss risk out the window. And it is one of those things that, yes, if you're going to leverage up, you have to understand what debt is. And it's basically using other people's money to leverage. And leverage is great when things are going up. It kills you when things go down. And if things are going to go up, or if you can withstand the storm, I've never seen real estate not go up over a 15-year period.
Well, it's because they keep printing money.
Well, yeah. So
it's hard not to go up when the money keeps getting worth less, right? Like it's sort of baked in, right?
Right. Well, kinda. Yes, they keep printing money, which is what the value of real estate actually generally goes up by. You're generally seeing real estate go up by the rate of inflation, and it's not anything else. And when you're leveraged 5-to-1, so 20% down, 80% mortgage, yeah. That if it's going to go,
if you got into South Florida in 2015 and you held till 2024, you know, obviously there's certain dynamics there that will, you know, further throw gas on the fire.
Sure.
Right.
100%.
But I think to that point, in general terms, inflation carries you, you know, at least part of the way. And you said you're a math guy, right?
I am a math guy.
I got this equation for you right now based on what you're saying. So it's debt plus real estate professional designation plus cost segregation equals rich guy status. Does that calc out?
That calcs. There we go. Okay. Love it.
All right. Well, I think that's all we got to do today then, Gino.
I'm going to just sum it up that way. You're going to start the podcast by, you want to know how to become a rich person? Follow the formula. Yeah, the formula is simple. Yeah. That and respect the debt. Those are the two slogans.
Well, I think like Wu-Tang Clan said that, but it might have been like inspect the deck. But anyways, it sounds very similar. So.
Yeah. So I one of the things, a lot of people, interest rates have changed over the past couple of years. Obviously, we've gone from a very, very, very low interest rate where money was really, really easy to a higher interest rates where money is now 6, 7, 8% at times. We've even seen it as high as 12 for some people when they have bad credit. It's a lot harder today to find really great deals than it was 3 years ago. And I generally see people, you're shaking your head thinking, no, deals are easy to find still. Is that?
No, I think every market, it comes with its own challenges, right? Like if you look just from my perspective, Gino's perspective, we don't raise capital. We buy deals with our own cash. We bought more deals last year than we did in the three previous years.
Did you use debt to finance or no?
Yes, we did.
Okay. And so, the deal still penciled out, still cash flowed from day one?
So the reason we did them because they were so much better than what we were seeing the three prior years, right? Okay. And you know, so many people, you know, get caught up in, look, the price is many times be reflective of the rate too. Right. Sure. And the demand that's out there. So we saw people getting a little skittish that probably wanted to sell prior. Rates doubled. Therefore, we were picking stuff up for less.
Sure.
We were buying at a higher rate. Okay.
Yeah.
But so we also know that we have 5 years fixed on those rates and we're looking to exit when things get back to around 4.5. And when I say exit, it go to, you know, a Fannie deal. Right. So not exit like a sale, but
exit the
loan.
So
it's, yeah, we picked something up that, you know, we felt was, you know, each one of those deals we felt were, you know, had a tremendous amount of upside, you know, blew past 1% rule. And we were very excited to own them for the long term. So I think it's just, you got to find your pitch in each part of the cycle. And it's not to say we didn't do deals in 21, 22, but we're doing only like 100 units a year, where we did 300 units last year. Because we, you know, things opened up for us.
Sure.
So. Yeah. But I do agree with your point. Sorry to overspeak, that most people did pull back where we pushed in a little harder.
Right.
And I do think that's the case.
I think it's Warren Buffett that said, when blood's in the street, you buy.
Yeah.
People are celebrating, you sell. Right. And so it's in 2000, I saw people in 2007, 2008 that literally lost everything. I saw other people that were buying in 2008, 2009. That became like ultra, ultra, ultra rich. When the markets crashed, they went in and gobbled up a ton of properties. Mm-hmm. And today those properties, like from 2007 to today, those properties have gone up in value. But if people couldn't hold over that 15-year period, they lost their shirts.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You gotta, hold it. Yeah, for sure.
But anybody who bought after, once the markets crashed, we're just gobbling up prices. And the thing with real estate is generally, in most terms, it goes up. It's not quite as volatile as the stock market, but it is still volatile, right? You still are going to have ups and downs. Like you said, to your point, people that thought they could sell it at one price, you ended up getting in at lower prices than you could have a year prior, because interest rates went up and that property then became more expensive on the, to finance it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, one of the things I caution people all the time with that, just honestly, truly run your numbers. And if you can hold real estate for 10, 15 years, because they are printing money and it's not that the properties are often worth more, it's that the dollar is worth less. Mm-hmm. Even with debt, like as long as you can service that debt, just I tell people, whenever you go into real estate, figure you're going to be in that property for at least 15 years. If you figure that and you can weather that storm for 15 years, you're going to make money with real estate. It's almost impossible not to, unless you're in Detroit or Cleveland. But
and that goes to the population component. But no, I think that's pretty well said. Getting a little long here. Best way for folks to get a hold of you?
So my website is anderson.tax. I think it's actually, you can also email me at preston@anderson.tax.
And Gino, that formula again, in case you weren't writing it down, debt plus real estate professional designation plus cost segregation equals rich guy status. Put that on the back of a t-shirt and smoke it, Gino.
There we go.
What say you, Jake? That
bring
says
us home.
You. I will bring you
home,
home,
dude.
You have a young Preston Anderson in high school, not really part of the cool crew. You know, he's hanging out and he's saying to himself, I like this math stuff. I'm a smart dude. I'm into this calculus stuff. Whereas Jake and Gino are not into the calculus stuff.
Still addition, right? Yeah.
And he graduates and he aspires to become an accountant, the tax person. He takes an accounting course and he says, wow, this is pretty cool. And why did I get into it? I got into it because I love to save people money. And on a side note, I don't really think tax law is unconstitutional. So I'm trying to make people avoid it, not evade it. It's tax avoidance versus tax evasion.
Boston Tea Party, baby.
And there's a lot of ways to do it. And what I would do is just go to Preston Anderson, go to his website, learn how to do it. And please don't make the mistake that he made of losing $200,000. Get